Is there a destiny out there that we Alaskans do not yet have the imagination to reach out and grab? Is 50 years long enough to learn? Good morning and welcome to the first AK at 100 edition of Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. We've said a lot about Alaska history over the years, but what will our history look like when the state turns 100? Let's hear your thoughts from around the state at 1-800-478-8255 and Anchorage a local call at 550-8422. Email talk. Oh, wait a minute. That's not the email anymore. I better check on that one. AK at 100 on Talk of Alaska statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Oh, yeah. This is going to be fun. I get to have my dream panels come on because this is an area where everybody's an expert. You'd think you'd have to be an Alaskan to be an expert, but I'm actively thinking that Joe McGinnis would be a really good panelist to discuss this subject, and some other people from out of state who have passed through Alaska or learned about Alaska down through the years. But this time, a couple of Alaskans. Elston Lawson, you grew up here, right?
I did. I grew up in Fairbanks.
Well, tell me a little bit about yourself.
Well, as you indicate, I'm a lifelong Alaskan. Grew up in Fairbanks, actually North Pole. Went through the school system up in interior Alaska. Went to the University of Alaska Fairbanks and the old Alaska Pacific University system, and then did a brief stint at Harvard, and then I came back to Alaska and pursued my life here, working mostly with rural affairs.
And a lot of Native corporations and stuff like that.
Oh, absolutely.
And yeah. Tribes.
And tribes. Particularly, my heart is with the tribes. I am an enrolled member of the Mountain Village Tribe, and I am also a Lac du Flambeau Chippewa.
Wow. Well, it's great to have you here, and I kind of know you as a friend and a person who shares a mutual interest in philosophy, particularly epistemology, and you know, those people aren't that many of them.
That's right. Absolutely. Thank God it's still legal.
Well, I've always thought there might be some economic benefit to an examined mind, but I haven't found it yet. Maybe we'll come across the solution in this program, Elston.
I hope so.
Also with me is Ron Holmstrom. Ron, I don't even know where to start because you've got like even screen credits and stuff. You've been on TV shows. You're an actor. You're in the Screen Actors Guild. And you came to Alaska some years ago and kind of fell in love with it.
Yeah, I came up here in 92. My mom and dad had retired up here, and I came up to take care of dad when he was dying. And I discovered Jerry and Sandy Harper at Cyrano's and old, you know, Hollywood expatriates, and I stayed to do a show, and, well, here we all are.
So I think I'll start with you, Ron. You're also a member of the Anchorage Cultural Council, and you're kind of this sort of tireless promoter of the cultural scene in Alaska, and Anchorage in particular. We've seen, like, everybody loves whales. I know you've got a movie project, and I want you to tell us about that. Do you think it's actually happening here now?
I think it can be. I think whatever adjustments the legislature does in the next session regarding the incentive program will completely tell the tale whether we're attractive or not. Right now we are. Right now we're very very attractive place to shoot.
And all kinds of weird shoots are happening. Shoots we don't even know about till afterwards. I see you. You're kind of plugged into it. You actually get to do casting calls and stuff like that. I'm on your email list, and you get casting calls every week.
Yeah, I do. Yeah, a lot of theater, you know, yeah. But occasional films and reality shows and such.
Yeah.
Yeah, I try and stray away from the reality shows because they're not union, and I am the SAG rep for the state, so, you know, it just kind of cross purposes.
Yeah, well, of course. But it was letting amateurs in the business, you know. They don't know the basics.
Well, they don't, you know, but how do you learn? So, yeah. You know.
Yeah, I was in our discussions of that issue. What I've heard is that the business has cycles, and when the money drained out of it, it made reality production economically attractive. And so it's probably, you know, there's going to be more of it. But if there were more money, there'd probably be a bunch of other more imaginative things going on, more scripted stuff.
Well, it always gets down to what, you know, what the audience will allow. You know, if they want to see that reality shows, then, you know, then they get big ratings and there's going to be more of them. And they're cheap.
Yeah.
God, they're cheap to do. You know, yeah. They can come up, you know, it's like, you know, you spend $8 on a program, hire actors for $3 a day and, you know, dress them up, shoot it, go back to Hollywood and sell it for $4 million.
Well, you just love it, don't you?
Yeah, as you can tell, I'm a big fan of screwing actors.
Well, Heimel's doing a reality show right now.
I know, and I'm on it, yeah.
Yes, it is true. We are now viewed on 360 North, Talk of Alaska and all its, all its visual glory. Well, okay, you know, the exercise on this program is to try and look ahead to 47 years from now, when Alaska turns 100, and to try and picture what the state would be like then. You know, I'm not likely to be there. Elston, probably you, probably none of us will be there. And I can start with this. I can start with saying, I think it's very unlikely my grandchildren will be here. I don't know that their career fields will turn out to be anything that they could do in the state of Alaska. Much as I would like them to be here, maybe they will be, but it seems unlikely. But picturing, you know, it's not all that long, and especially, you know, in the eyes of senior citizens like the three of us, it's not all that long, 50 years. And 50 years, 47 years from now, you know, what things you can actually see happening now that you know will be major forces in Alaska. And I'm thinking that our dreams 50 years from now, the Alaska dream will still be a national and probably an international dream, something that people want to know about.
Well, Steve, if I could jump in, is that kosher here?
Absolutely.
Well, thank you, Steve. Well, a few things that we know based on trends are going to occur 50 years from now. We know that the state of Alaska will have a population a little over 1 million people. Probably 60% of that population is going to be concentrated in a few cities. We know because of global warming or climate change, if you happen to be a conservative on the issue, that there's terraforming occurring in the coast that's going to create access to resources. And one can almost imagine the North Slope of Alaska kind of becoming a cold version of Galveston, deploying outer continental shelf development for energy. We know that water is going to become increasingly important. And
that's a really good one.
My own expectation is, and my own hope, is that Metlakatla Reservation becomes the Saudi Arabia of Alaska as far as water is concerned. Hmm.
It does rain down there a lot.
Oh, it certainly does. And remember Walter Hickel's vision decades ago of a hose running from Alaska to the West Coast. And there was some laughter attending that. Well, nobody's laughing now. That is actually quite a viable vision. So 50 years is a long time, as you say. And I remember very clearly 50 years ago, and some of the things that we were thinking about and talking about and projecting into the future, and we could not have imagined what we are facing today in this state. So considering this the midpoint of your visionary question, we need to make a lot of changes politically, changes culturally, and changes in attitude, because we have gone in 50 years from a progressive vision of the state to a dystopia, practically, where we can't make decisions. And hopefully that will change and the next generation will be better.
You know, it's very odd. If you look back to the immediate, right after statehood, and you discover that the Democrats were the ones that didn't want Anwar preserved.
Isn't that funny?
Yeah. And so, you know, sometimes these political winds will just blow this way. That it's cyclical. I think we can safely predict in a space of 50 years, it'll go through a few cycles. But you never know, like, there might be some decision points between here and where this pendulum swings, or whatever you want to call it, that we go through that we can't get back from. You know, mm-hmm. I think that can happen. But let me ask you this, Elston. Alaska as a state has, and before it was a state, going all the way back to the Russians, has always been in the posture of being a colony. It's always been a question of whose colony is it? And I'm wondering if there's such a habit of mind in Alaska that we just assume the position. We just assume the position. Who's going to exploit us next? Is it will be the oil companies? Oh, well, will it be the mineral companies next?
Well, part of it, Steve, is the character of the demographics of Alaska. I was looking in terms of the projection. I was looking at an interesting graph that showed the high points of the last 40 years, the reasons for in-migration and out-migration in Alaska. And as soon as the Trans-Alaska Pipeline started, there were a bunch of people came to Alaska. As soon as it finished, 13,000 people left Alaska. Ronald Reagan's recession of 82 and 83, a bunch of people came to Alaska. The Alaskan recession of 87 and 88, tens of thousands of people left Alaska. I mean, it's this ebb and flow. And every time...
A real lack of identity. Everybody that was here before the pipeline says that. We lost our identity.
Something like 50% of our population turns over every 4 years.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
What an incredible number.
It is. Yeah. It is. But that's all new audiences, Ron.
Well, see, that's the thing depressions hit, recessions hit. People still want to go out and sit in a dark place and have somebody make them laugh and cry.
Oh, yeah.
And that's where we come in, the theater business anywhere is terrifically difficult. You know, it's a struggle for every theater company, every smaller theater company, of which we have plenty here, and they all seem to just kind of, plug along. Now, the movie industry coming here, that's a whole new thing. If we can develop the infrastructure that we desperately need to support it, it could be a going concern here.
But, I think those paradigms are all going to just get bent all out of whack. In 50 years, all those paradigms are going to just get so weirded out. Because even now, people have so many, so much access to technology themselves. You have YouTube hits, and that's just the beginning. just the beginning. You're going to see just all kinds of stuff. And Alaska's place in this, when you think about it, is interesting. Because first, if there really is a national and an international hunger for imagination of Alaska, that becomes a marketable commodity as we start losing some of the logistical problems that you have with having to transport goods or whatnot. It's a dream. And when you have broadband, especially into the bush, a dream can just... viral, man.
A guy or gal with a top of the line cell phone right now can do their own TV show.
Yeah,
and the market is changing rapidly. In fact, my guild, the Screen Actors Guild, we just negotiated over the last 2 years what we call the new media contracts.
Yeah,
which tries to cover as much of this rapidly growing and evolving stuff as we can. But then who knows what's going to happen in the next 8 minutes.
Well, in fact, we saw a video from Quinnahock go viral last Christmas.
Right, and it was great. I did my share passing that one on.
it's a wonderful new. There's not a lot of money in it, so it can't. It's hard to make a living at it, but
those economics will change too, though.
They will.
But we are, if I have time to say this, we are limited by our imagination. An example is this recent oil tax debate. It seems like everybody favoring the cut in the oil taxes is trying to envision going back to the future. They want to try to give these breaks so they can drill more wells so we can relive the glory days of the 1980s. But really what we should be looking at is dealing with research and development. ConocoPhillips spends $250 million a year on research and development and energy in partnerships with universities in the lower 48. Why aren't we trying to leverage our position with ConocoPhillips, who is one of the underwriters of this program, I might add, to move their research and development operation to Alaska rather than simply look at spudding more wells and doing the same old, same old? We need to be tracking the changes that are being contemplated by the energy industry itself. And it just frustrates me when I see politicians and policymakers
just
not
going back into the same old groove.
Yeah.
But there is, I think economically, legitimately, you could say that you've got to have investment, and then you worry, well, you know, maybe we invest a permanent fund. We have that chunk of investment we have, but for the most part, you have to lure the investment. You have to find some capitalist somewhere. And you know, certainly old school Chamber of Commerce and everything, they're all about that, right?
Yeah, but we didn't have to learn to lure Pencil and Great Bear to come up here and invest $750 million in a exploration and development effort. So.
Yeah, I've been very impressed with the ENI project, which you don't hear much about, but essentially that is so, the investment they have to put in terms of what return they get is just so marginal, they wouldn't be able to do it except that they're very horizontally integrated, as they say. So they're using all their own technology to do this, what any other oil company couldn't do. They just happen to know how to do it.
Wait, what is that, ENI? I'm not...
It's an Italian national oil company.
Oh, really?
Yeah. they have one of the fields up offshore, slightly offshore.
Wow.
On the North Slope. You don't hear much about it. But it's the yellow flag with the strange animal with the multiple legs. And the tail up in the air.
But it's interesting, you raised the question about cultural opportunities in the future. And hopefully 50 years from now, we really have the Yupiak culture at the table helping us resolve some of the issues that we're going to be facing at that time.
I can't even imagine that we wouldn't. I mean, well, I've seen the value in my time in Alaska to the scientific community grow tremendously. Now starting to see in the educational system, too.
Well, Dr. Oscar Quagley, who just passed away, great loss to the state. You mentioned the word epistemology. That was his dissertation was actually about a Yupiak epistemology and the utility of the Yupiak language in being able to analyze and assess natural conditions. And perhaps one of the missing pieces of the puzzle we are looking at is right before our eyes in the Yupiak culture.
Our telephone number is 1-800-478-8255. We have a couple of loquacious guests, so you really got to, you got to be aggressive about it. Get that call in, 1-800-478-8255, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. The guests are supposed to be here to talk with you, so let's get those calls going. Imagining Alaska at 100. And I think, Elston, you brought up a really important point, not just the multicultural point, and Alaska's cultural future in terms of cultural worldview future, but also that so often when you look back 50 years and you see what's important now, it was there 50 years ago, it was just smaller. So in a sense, we're already stumbling over our own future. It's right in front of us, we're just sort of ignoring it. I mean, I look at the, you talk of a multi-ethnic future, and I'm involved with all these food sustainability people, local vores, and all that sort of thing. And yet, you know, if I really look at it objectively, it's the Koreans and the Russians and all these old ladies and natives that are just, they're foraging our city right now, being totally ignored by it. You know, it's, our telephone number, once again, is 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK. And Stu joins the program from Muldoon, Alaska. Stu, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Thanks, Steve. Yeah, 50 years. You were right on the money. You kind of beat me to the punch. I've observed the Koreans and the Russian immigrants, and they network really well to help their entire community succeed. And it's not like you can't join them, but yeah, I think, you know, after growing up here and being born and raised, just so many folks come up from the lower 48. You know, they spend their 5 years or 10 years and their history. And what do they leave? So I think the history is going to belong to, or the future is going to probably be largely in the hands of ethnic groups that can network really well, or people who can network well to get things across. But the one thing that I can see happening now is the mercury poisoning of the rural waters, especially north of the Brooks Range, because of burning of coal. That is something. Remember, the Daily News had that story that the Wonder Lake there at the end of the highway, the road going into Denali National Park, is too polluted to eat out of, and mercury poisoning of standing water north of the Brooks Range is the worst in the country as far as non-urban pollution, especially now with nuclear getting a real bad rap after Tohoku Daiichi. I think we're going to see a lot more coal burned, and we're going to see a lot more mercury pollution up here, and it's probably going to get worse, as the scientists have suggested, that as the ice pack melts up north, we'll have a change in jet streams, and we're going to have mercury-polluted water all over South Central.
I feel like I've been slapped in the face with a cold fish, and I better not eat that fish.
Yeah, fish you can't eat.
Yeah. All right, Stu. Yeah. Thanks for your call from Muldoon.
All right, thanks. Bye.
Yeah. Alice Rogoff was at talking at that Arctic Imperative thing yesterday, and they ran an interview last night where she was saying, well, we really need to wake up. There's going to be a whole lot of shipping going through the Bering Straits, and it's not necessarily going to be clean. Somebody's going to have to regulate this, and so far we haven't taken step one.
Was that Alice Rogoff?
Yeah, it was.
Good for her. She's absolutely right. One other opportunity, if I can add maybe a happier note to the conversation, is the Yupik people have a medicine that grows in the area, and it's called Chaklok, and it is basically Artemisia tilesi, and it's in the sage family, and it has all kinds of medicinal applications, and this this kind of plant and these kinds of traditional medicinals could really spur the basis for a biomedical research area. One of the bets I think we're missing right now, but hopefully 50 years in the future we will have taken advantage of it, is the fact that we have 4 major hospitals located within the footprint of the University of Alaska, and it seems to me that we could merge those things in kind of a research triangle for biomedical research, given the developments in nanotechnology and biophysics that are going on, that are going to fundamentally alter our ways of health and our ways of life. It would be great if Alaska were catching that wave rather than ignoring it.
You know, as long as I can remember, people have wanted to retire to Florida because it's warm. You don't come from the East Coast. Florida, because it's warm, or Arizona because the air is good for their lungs. And can you picture a time that people might want to actually retire to Alaska because it's cold? I'm serious.
Yeah.
I'm serious. I mean, already we're seeing, ferocious drought in several places, along with ferocious flooding.
Yeah, interesting.
You know, whatever the cause you may want to impute that to, maybe cold becomes comes to have an economic value at some point. Cold is the thing that condenses the water.
Well, my mom and dad retired up here, I think, in 75. And the place, they didn't come up here for the warmth, They came up, mainly, the outdoors people, and, it's just a great place to live, But that's an interesting concept, people retiring to Alaska because it's cold.
It could happen. Years ago, I met this Dr. Clarence Zener at the Carnegie Institute of Technology. He became Carnegie Mellon University. And he had this idea of generating power simply through the temperature differential of the ocean. And lo and behold, he invented the Zener diode. He's a famous engineer. And people took him seriously, and they actually built this rig to siphon the water, the cold water up, and you know, generate electricity with it. You know what it ended up being used for? It ended up being used just getting the cold water up to the shore of Hawaii. Mm-hmm. Turned out to be that the coldness of the water was the resource that could be used to make all sorts of pharmaceutical products. And they're doing that now. They're doing that on a big island, quite a lot of it, with that same technology that they thought was going to be power plants.
Incredible.
What a clever observation. I mean, I have to commend you on that. That's great.
Yeah,
amazing. Maybe you're right. We have the Cold Weather Research Lab, and we know certainly that the environmental the interaction between surface temperature and the atmosphere has certain effects that can be good with respect to communication. Who knows?
Yeah. Yeah, and in like fashion, here's another wild one. But let's say that the economy, the basis of the economy based on commodities and whatnot, is really maybe not going to sustain too much longer, or not in a kind of form that it has. And so you have whatever, some kind of implosion. And this doesn't necessarily yield a survival situation where everybody else is scraping out and, you know, whacking one another over the heads to steal one another's food. But what it might do is enhance the value of these indigenous cultural resources you were talking about, Elston, that suddenly this is the very definition of resilience and adaptation. Knowing what grows wild, what you can do with what you've got, what the environment is going to do, this knowledge starts to have more economic value when you have less of a commodified economy.
And our proactive responsibility is to, through the university and the state in a partnership, is to make sure that those resources, those indigenous resources and applications remain in the public domain, because far too many resources in Africa and South America are being patented, genetically patented, by companies, and we need to make sure that things like chaklok are maintained in a public domain fashion so we can go ahead and develop them for the public good.
By golly. Yeah. What is it, Devil's Club? There's a lot with Devil's Club, isn't there?
Yes, absolutely. Yes, yeah. The it's actually the root of the Devil's Club.
Oh, really?
Rather than the leaf.
And, yeah, thankfully.
And yeah, right. And yes, it has medicinal.
Ron, well, I'm going to throw this one to you, Ron. He's talking about medicinal plants, and I'm thinking hemp and marijuana, and I can't help, it just pops into my head. There's quite the cash crop already in Alaska here. And I'm thinking, in 50 years, do we really have the same attitude in the state of Alaska that we do now towards these substances? I mean, it seems like we're long past time for a change, maybe not on cannabis, but maybe on, like, say, alcohol. You know, alcohol is, like, it's killing us, costing us all kind of money.
Yeah, worse here than anywhere, actually.
And it seems like sooner or later, we ought to sort of come to our senses in some way, whether it's just a cultural matter or just discovering better therapeutic tools or whatever, law and order. I don't really know. It just seems that something's going to happen in 50 years.
Well, it seems to me that if in 50 years the war on drugs still hasn't worked, maybe we should reexamine it.
Amen. That's my soundbite for the show. As Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from First National Bank Alaska, branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com, member FDIC, equal housing lender, and by
the Center for Distance Education at UAF, offering access to online courses from any location. Information at distance.uaf.edu/learn.
Well, this is so much fun. I think we'll keep playing. This is the AK at 100, Part 1, Talk of Alaska. We'll be doing more shows on this theme, and we intend to expand it as well to the web, so that on the website we can just kind of keep threads going and keep playing this one, because there are so many different ways that it might could be developed, and it's so interesting, really, to think about the future. They asked a science fiction writer, an Alaska science fiction writer, what do you think Alaska will be like in 100 years? And he said, well, we'll have teleportation, so all the rich people will have taken over, and everybody else will be kicked out. It'll be a gated community. Just saying. We got Elston Lawson and Ron Holmstrom with us today, and we're just trying to envision what kind of future we might have in this state, what kind of future we could have in this state. Probably need to look at this food thing a little bit more, but let's see. Maybe Joanne and Homer will help us. Joanne, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Hi. I had a couple ideas. I'm hoping that within 50 years, maybe the railroad could loop through western Alaska so that they have access without having to fly or barge everything in. And connected with that, maybe the YK Delta could become the new place to grow cool weather crops, since the lower 48 has a lot of ground weather problems and they're heating up. And Iceland is planning to do a whole bunch with geothermal powering computer servers, and we have a lot of geothermal, so why not go that route?
Good.
Joanne?
Yeah.
Hi, this is Elston. You hit three buttons. It's absolutely great. First of all, the server concept is absolutely right on, because a few of the things that they are looking for, criteria for location of server farms, are cheap power, remoteness for physical security, and connectivity, of course. And right now we're seeing
computers cool.
We're seeing a lot of that's right, power to keep computers cool, but we're seeing a lot of fiber optic being run around the coast of Alaska, western Alaska, southwest Alaska. Eventually, we're going to have, certainly in 50 years, we're going to have a web of a fiber optic that's going to connect us to the backbone that will make that possible. The second thing that you mentioned was the Kuskokwim becoming a cold weather agricultural area. Well, in fact, there is a history of that happening. The Jesuit nuns and fathers in their various schools in the Kuskokwim did have successful farms. It was, in fact, a very rich source of agriculture back in the 1930s. And you mentioned one other thing.
Railroad.
Oh, the railroad, yes. There was a study done by the University of Alaska in the late 1960s, called a multimodal transportation study. Ernie Wolf was the lead researcher on that. And they studied all the different types of transportation options for resources, getting resources out, and the two that came to the top for minimum impact on the environment and efficiency were slurry pipeline and railroads. Railroads are a great option for what you suggest.
The other thing about going through western Alaska, when people talk about a road, is folks in the villages don't need a car. So you connect them with the road, and they're going to either have to invest in a car, or they're not going to be able to use the transportation. So I really think that the railroad beats the highway bit to western Alaska.
Yeah, well, of course, I think the administration is actively looking at trying to get the railroad to go up to Ambler, because there's all the minerals up there. And the idea that you could do the ore transportation, you know, to cheapen moving the ore out. And from time to time, they do high-grade some of those ores even now. And I think we're kind of, that's another case where we're trying to picture the future, not realizing we're stumbling over it already, that, you know, there's all kinds of mining claims that you could work right now. The price of gold is so high, you can work mining claims again.
yeah, you can.
And with the circuit boards and things like that, demand skyrocketing in China, it's likely that Alaska is going to have to, find a way to effectively regulate the mining industry.
Yes.
Without losing our fish.
Oh, yeah. And hopefully not getting mercury in the air.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Joanne, thanks for those thoughts from Homer. That was really terrific.
My pleasure.
It's Talk of Alaska, 1-800-478-8255. We're looking at Alaska at 100. This is part one of an ongoing series of shows we will be doing. Let's go to Billy, who joins the program from Kotzebue. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Billy.
All righty. Thanks for taking my call. Well, the first 50 years, it is well documented that the state of Alaska was always against subsistence. And, you know, every time we go to get a license, we're having to hunt like big game hunters. And, you know, if we don't get what they're saying we need to get, then, you know, they take everything away. And hopefully they will down the road recognize our way of life. And that's my comment.
Thank you, Billy. It is true that even in 1971, the Native Claim Settlement Act extinguished Aboriginal hunting and fishing rights, and they weren't really put back together in a way that I think anybody is satisfied with in 1980. They just weren't.
Well, I'm not so sure that I don't agree with the extinguishment of Aboriginal hunting and fishing rights.
You mean that they were, or that the law said they were?
No, that the law said they were. I am an absolute supporter of subsistence and hunting and fishing rights, and they're there whether they're permitted by law or not. It goes back to the old adage that a right is a right because you use it, not because somebody gives it to you. And subsistence use of resources for local people in the villages, man, that is just as basic as you can get. And 50 years from now, if we don't have that issue solved, then everything else is bupkis, as my ex-father-in-law used to say.
Bupkis, love it.
Well, and that depends a lot on the maintenance of the herds and the protection of the critters that are out there. And doesn't our Constitution, wasn't the fight about subsistence and subsistence rights, didn't somebody point up the Constitution guarantees, you know, the same hunting, fishing rights for all Alaskans?
Not quite. So it's going to be reserved for the common use.
Yeah.
And we probably better not go down that rabbit trail because go ahead, Elston.
All right. Well, just let me point out that whatever you say about Alaska is what you're saying for 103 million acres, period. If you looked at a map of Alaska, the true map of Alaska would be a bunch of scattered inholdings within a large federal management area. And the federal law is clear with respect to subsistence. It's just a few vested interests in Alaska trying to manipulate the political process. Yeah, maybe you're right, Steve. We shouldn't go down this.
I mean, there's no end to it. Let's go to Dave, joins the program from Fairbanks. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Dave.
How you doing?
Great.
Well, boy, it took me a long time to get through, but this is a subject that I think about a lot. Because I'm a transplant, I wasn't born here, and one thing that I real difference between Alaska and the Lower 48 is that we don't make anything here.
Yeah.
People come here, they scoop stuff up and take it out of here, or they suck it out of the ground or whatever, and it goes out of here raw. And then when it's gone, they leave, you know, and we don't produce anything. And nobody that has a truck will come up here because there's nothing to take back.
Yeah,
he's absolutely right.
And then on top of that, something that seemed obvious to me, I've been here about 30 years, something that seemed obvious to me then that other people can't get a handle on is there needs to be a bridge, a railroad bridge, between here and Russia. That way the entire world gets connected by rail, and that puts Alaska right in the middle of it. What I asked Tony Knowles about that once when he was running for governor. I said, what's more important, a railroad or a gas pipeline? He popped out gas pipeline without even thinking. And then when I told him the benefits of a railroad, he started changing his mind, but he didn't get elected.
Yeah, well, of course, the Wally Hickel was always pushing, you know, almost anything like power lines or what, a tunnel, some way of getting across there. Yeah.
It puts us right in the middle of everything, and it connects. The only thing that's not connected is Africa. But, you know, they can worry about building the bridge over there later. If we've got Europe and Asia connected to North and South America, and we're right in the middle of it, we're golden, man.
All right. Thanks a lot. That was great, Dave.
Yeah, we do at some point have to start manufacturing something.
Yeah. It's true. I mean, one of our, Elston lives right by one of the biggest manufacturing facilities in the entire state. It's a bakery.
Right. Yeah.
That's true. Every morning I can smell baked bread.
Mm-mm. Oh, man, that's wonderful.
Maybe for a while. Well, let's go to Bob Joins the program from Southeast Bay. Hi, Bob.
Hello.
Hello.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. Just a few comments about Southeast. I live on Prince of Wales Island, and we used to be a big timber producer. Now I see down the road where biofuel is going to be a big producer in Southeast. We've got an infant industry starting down here now. Also, reuse of second growth timber for things like biochips or plywood or something you don't need tight grain wood for. And also we're seeing a resurgence in the exploration on rare earth mines. There's a couple of them here just within 20 miles of where I live. Any rate, I see a resurgence in growth in Southeast down the road just because of our commodities. Okay, that's about it for me.
All right, Bob. Yeah, thank you very much. And it is, sometimes I don't even, you know, it's hard for me to picture the wealth of Prince of Wales, but there certainly is a lot of resources there.
Could I share a little story? I was working as the socioeconomic advisor to the state pipeline coordinator back in the late 1970s, early 1980s.
Must be Walt Parker?
That was Chuck Belkey at the time.
Okay.
This was during the Hammond administration. And we had a visit from a delegation from Sweden. Sweden had just inked a deal with the then Soviet Union to the Soviet Union was going to export gas to Sweden. Sweden was going to build a pipeline and then provide a link to gas to the rest of Europe. And they came to Alaska, and this was about 1980 or 81, and to find out how we planned for our pipeline, and they wanted to learn from us. And so there was a big meeting up in Fairbanks, and Terry Miller, the then lieutenant governor, was facilitating the meeting. And this fellow from Sweden stood up in the back of the room, and he raised his hand, and he said, we've been traveling around for about a week now, and we're all mystified. He said, here is a town of about 50,000 people, and we would like to know, where are your factories? Where are your manufacturing centers? What do you make here? And I'm sitting there going, damn good question. And Terry turns to me because I'm the socioeconomic guy, right? And he says, Elston? And I had to stand up and say, we don't do that. And then, of course, the follow-up question is, well, how has the pipeline facilitated your doing that since it's so basic in terms of economy? I said, well, it really... doesn't, though we are trying for gas liquids and this sort of thing.
Yeah, a little refinery here.
Yeah, a little, whatever. And it was a pretty embarrassing moment for me to face such logical questions and not be able to give a logical answer.
Where are your factories?
Where are our factories?
But, you know, the reason, you know, it's sort of like Bucky Fuller used to like to tout Brazil, because he said they don't have to build roads because they can use airplanes, you know. They can go right to the newest technology. And we're seeing China trying to, you know, develop that way, too. They leapfrog with their development. Maybe we can see that in Alaska, where we can just be more of a part of the cybersphere because it doesn't have all the expenses of the transportation logistics. Maybe that's what we have to manufacture. Things are a little less tangible, Elston. What do you think?
Well, maybe railroad going the other way to Canada.
Well,
well, if there's going to be an agricultural boom here, then we got to transport that stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Well, one thing we do have, which is our newest industry, and of course I'm a strong proponent for movies, it's green industry, and it produces stuff and sends it outside. Now, what just happened up here with whales is they came into town and they dropped a few million dollars here right into the economy, jobs and all the ancillary stuff that goes with it. I mean, you know, it's everybody from who shines shoes to, you know, your florist. Now, that's great. They dumped millions here. The thing is our own industry here of producing our films here, well, see, when Wales is done, and now they're gone, and now every penny that that movie makes goes right back to Universal Studios in California. However, films that are produced here locally and shows that are produced here locally, while that money comes back into the economy here, my friend David Cuddy, that I just worked on a film with him, Christmas with a Capital C. Well, we know where Cuddy banks. Right,
so I reckon we do.
And we know that he sold that movie, and it's again coming on this Christmas on the cable station. So all that money comes right back to Alaska. So while Wales made a gang of money, and we have to encourage those outside the studios to come here and shoot films, it really behooves us to do stuff like David's doing, and to an extent what I'm trying to do with the doppelganger principle. If we had a studio here, if somebody would finally build a soundstage I've been asking for 20 some years, we could draw the business here.
You know, this intellectual property thing, I don't want to let go of that, though. It would seem to me, and I've noticed this too, is if you're a musician, comes a point where you have to leave Alaska in order to make it. It's very hard to stay here because the market just isn't big enough. And artists, you know, it's very difficult to be like a visual artist, a sculptor or whatnot. You're basically living off percent for art for the most part, or artists in the schools or this gig or that gig, because Alaska's art is not taken that seriously in the rest of the world.
Or here.
Well, maybe it should be. But the artists often are. When they leave, they are.
Okay.
And so it's that intellectual property we have to learn to hang on to somehow, that this actually is a real resource.
And that's the hard part.
Like Elston was talking about. He's always saying, well, throw it to the university, invest in it, you know, put it into the educational system, make it institutional. You know, you've said that several times about things that we brought up. Well, maybe the same way you need to do that with knowledge and intellectual property.
One of the solutions might be for the state of Alaska to actually invest in, like ADA invests in infrastructure, like they're doing with the jackup rig in Cook Inlet. Maybe they could take an equity position in some of the movies that we would then attract through our tax benefit program. And Steve, I'm glad you mentioned musicians. I wanted to get to that point. What a wonderful resource we have here in Alaska. We have artists like Marianne Call, for example. Brilliant musician, but not only that, a brilliant producer.
She is.
She manages her entire tours and figures it all using Twitter and the internet. And Facebook, and I think she's a genius.
She just did was absolutely amazing.
And she made money, you know? And so that's a model that Alaskans could use, Alaskan artists. And we should be promoting people like Marianne Call. Bumua, another great group. They're a fusion group with indigenous ties to this state. They are a treasure and a resource that we need to be encouraging.
Terrific music, too.
Oh, absolutely.
As Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska.
I am so sorry. I forgot to give the new email address. And then I'm looking here and say, where's the emails? You know, they always, people are sitting there, they will be pounding their keys while they're listening to the show, and nothing. I'm thinking, is something wrong? Is it down? And I realize, no, it is a new email address, talk@alaskapublic.org. talk@alaskapublic.org. Alaska Public, like one word. That's the way we changed it. It's longer, but it's doable, it's typable, so... whatever.
Did you say talk@alaskapublic.org?
That's exactly what I said.
That's what I heard, too, talk@alaskapublic.org.
Unfortunately, we only have about 6 minutes. Robert and Barrow, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Yeah, good afternoon or good morning. Thank you very much for taking my call. Anyway, my concern is about our Alaska legislatures. I've been born and raised in the Arctic for 60 years, and we've seen oil development occur, and we've seen our Trans-Alaska pipeline go into production, and now they're looking at gas. And I think our legislatures has been directed so much by the industry, the oil industry, and they're forgetting about their own people that they represent. And I think we're hurting ourselves more in that fashion by us Alaskans, our real Alaskans, not really seriously addressing our energy resource issues. And here in the Arctic, Inupiat community of the Arctic has a 50-year energy plan before even Pluto had kicked in. And, you know, us Alaskans, the world wants our gas, our hydrocarbons. And like they said, the question was, where's our industries? We could put a lot of people to work if we can only... let our legislatures hold on to our resources, because they're coming. They're coming. And we just got to hold on to our gas pump instead of letting all these giants take what we have. And we're going to be hurting in the future if we let them have it.
Robert, I love the way that you're reflecting a good long view and talking about it as a gas bump.
Yes. They need to come to our gas pump. We can't be going to, we can't take our resources to them and then refine them and bringing them back to Alaska. You know, that's why we're paying so much.
All right, Robert. Thank you for your call. Elston, you want to chime in on this one?
I would. I think Robert makes a terrific point. One of the things I thought he was going to mention, but he didn't, but may go to the heart of the problem, the disconnect between public policy and our own, the needs of our own people, is the reapportionment of the legislature. The population concentrations from the in-migration go into cities, and so cities wind up electing the majority of the legislature, and the legislature shapes the policy. And legislators respond, well, we just had a case in Fairbanks of electing a legislator who's only been in the state for 5 years. Are we losing our capacity for self-governance as Alaskans when we have people who are barely in the state making policy?
A basic, solid civics question, Elston, that we don't have any answer for. It's Talk of Alaska. We're talking about what's Alaska going to be like in 100 years.
Will we be taking more advantage of the cybersphere? Where will our food be coming from? How about this one? Will we be training our own workforce? You know, because the jobs are not what our we train our young people for.
Well, a few years ago, my partner and one of my partners in this film, Jan Welt, and I taught acting for the camera up at UAA when ATY was still there. And it was a week-long class. We did it just like you're preparing to do a motion picture. You learned your lines. You studied your scenes. We rehearsed it. We lit it. We shot it. Everybody got a copy of their stuff. And we had people in there from, like, 12 to 60. And at the end of it, after we had the premiere at Wendy and their show, we had a film preview for them. They all saw their work on film and brought the friends and family. And at the end, they asked us, you know, okay, well, you know, now we feel pretty good about, you know, going from stage to screen. What do we do? And Jan and I looked at each other and I said, you got to get the hell out of here. You know, if you want a career, you know, then, you know, you can be, if you can get to be like, you know, like some of the actors that, you know, that can live in Washington State or and then fly back and forth, you know, but otherwise, and it's tragic. But
I think this is, you know, I'm always two minds on this with my, you know, vast almost 50-year career in this particular industry. On the one hand, I see people trying to do what seems like what I do, but they never learned the basics. And I think there's always going to be a market for those basics. And then on the other side of that, I just love it when some young person comes along and they just hip-hop it. They just hip-hop it and do things I would never, you know, we break every rule in the book and it sounds great. You know, there's both.
Yeah.
Well, guess what? We got 20 minutes to wrap it up. We got any closing thoughts there, Elston?
I think the future looks so bright, I got to wear shades.
Oh, yeah. I might have known.
Want to put in a plug for the show at Cyrano's, if you don't mind. Yeah, the 25th annual Putnam County Spelling Bee is opening there on July 8th. It's a delightful show, a really, really funny musical. And Teresa Pond, an Alaskan that now is a pretty successful director in New York, has come up to direct the show.
Okay, Ron, and also the motion picture we're working on, you've got Ed Asner coming to town again, right?
Yes, I do.
Tell me about it.
October 3rd, Ed hits town, and we start shooting this courtroom drama kind of thriller, and we're gearing up for it, my partners, Tiffany Gwynn and Jan Welt, so we're greased and ready to kick butt.
All right, thanks a lot. Thanks also to Dave Waldron, Josh Edge, and Heather Arano. I'm Steve Heimel. Thanks for listening.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by Alaska Business Monthly Magazine, publishing statewide news for over 26 years from Alaska's business sector, government, and industries. Information and subscription online at akbizmag.com. How do you get men to wear their life jacket when the fact is that 90% of boating-related fatalities in Alaska are men? Well, truthfully, most men won't listen to messages like this, but they might listen to you. Have them fill out a Pledge to Live card and make a promise to wear their life jacket every time they get in a boat. Every time. Get a Pledge to Live card at pledgetolive.org. Make them promise so they make it back alive. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.